Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Witchlit is brought to you by Thousand Volt Press, a family-owned independent publisher established to produce the books we want to see in the world. Titles including Changing Paths by Yvonne Abreu, Conjuring the Commonplace by Lane Fuller and Corey Thomas Hutchison, A Death in the Dry River by Lisa Allen Agostini, and my most recent book, Verona Green, can be purchased directly from thousandvoltpress.com or wherever you buy books. You can also support the show by buying us a cup of coffee at ko-fi.com/witchlitpodcast. Muriel Thompson is a writer and lover of all things gothic, haunting, and romantic. Her writing is largely inspired by her experiences with mental health and her studies in literary history. She holds two master's degrees in Romantic and Victorian Literature and Society, as well as creative writing, both from the University of Edinburgh. Her latest book is The Last Witch in Edinburgh. Muriel Thompson, welcome to Witchlit.
Ooh, thank you for having me.
I'm so excited to talk about it. I was like, the first line of your bio was like, oh, this could be mine as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it helps me find my people.
Yeah. So our first question, I can't wait to talk about the book, but our first question is for everybody on the show, especially in this age of, you know, visual media and short attention spans, why still write? Why still write books?
Yeah. I tried to think about it. I, you know, still not 100% certain, but I guess like long before I was ever a writer, I've been an avid reader my whole life. Like that was, you know, the Matilda style childhood of just like walking to the library every day, just like living inside books. And so I think that in a sense that sort of became like the language that I learned to view the world through, like communicate with the world. And I really do not believe that anything has like shaped me as a person, shaped my worldview as much as the book that I've read. So I guess it sort of seemed inevitable as I got older that I would write, just because that is like, you know, the language that I know to express emotions. And it always felt like something I wanted to do, to maybe like, you know, the books that I read as a child and as an adult, just there were some things that you're like, oh, I thought I was the only person that like felt this way or thought this way. And it just really makes you feel seen. And I just love the idea of, you know, somebody potentially feeling that reading one of my books.
Yeah, I love that. So the first thing I want to ask you, because I think listeners will immediately recognize that you do not have a brogue.
No.
So what?
Unfortunately.
Oh, yeah, I know. I could listen to anyone Scottish speak. They could read from the phone book. It'd be lovely. So what took you to Edinburgh?
Yeah, so I originally moved to Edinburgh for grad school. And it was, I like visited once in my teens, visited Edinburgh for like 2 days, fell in love and sort of became obsessed with learning about the history of the city. And like the country at large. And I've always studied literary history. So that's just like a huge interest. So I really knew that when I was going to get a master's degree in literary history, I was like, well, it's Scottish literature and Scottish history that I am really passionate about. So of course I wanted to go there. And then even after finishing my degree, I was just like, this is my home now. This is just like, you know, I was moved there and like early adulthood, and that just sort of became where I became an adult, where I found my people and myself. And so I just stayed there for a while, and I just absolutely adored it. Even now, like I haven't lived in Edinburgh in about 2 years, and I still like think of that as my home.
Yeah,
miss it very much.
Yeah, it was. I have to say, I was kind of surprised to find out you were not Scottish after finishing the book, because, and I don't want to spoil the book for anybody, but we were obviously going to talk about it. But it is such a love letter to Edinburgh. And also there's like this, like in the main character, there's such a deep longing for the city itself. And I was like, that, I mean, it's unsurprising that you live there, but I really thought, oh, person is from Edinburgh.
Yeah, I mean, that second half of the book where the main character has that like intense homesickness for Edinburgh. I pretty much rewrote most of that second half about 6 months, in the first 6 months after I moved out of the city. So it looked very different in its first draft that I wrote while I was still living there. So I think that like intense longing did just sort of come from how I was feeling. Like I love where I live now, and I like, you know, getting to see different places. But, you know, like I said, that still so much so feels like home. Yeah. That like intense longing just came out without me realizing it.
Yeah. Well, and I think that first like 6 months to a year when you move someplace completely new, like it's almost like a liminal year. Like you're in both places at the same time mentally, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was also when I was living in Edinburgh, like I lived right near Arthur's Seat and like Salisbury Crags. And that is a very important location in the book as well. But I would like every day, if I had the time before or after work, go on like 2-3 hour long walks around, you know, the nature part of the city, the main part of the city. So I just like knew it like the back of my hand. And of course, because I'm obsessed with history, I had to learn the history of like every little thing that interested me. So yeah, it definitely became very ingrained in me. So I'm glad that I got to write a book that is a love letter to the city.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, there's so many layers to this book. Like, I don't really know where to start.
it's a complicated one.
But I mean, you know, it's funny. And I always do like a little internet sleuthing. And occasionally I will go read reviews of books I'm going to talk about with folks just because I kind of want to see what other people are saying. And I mean, the reviews are overall fantastic for the book. But I noticed that a couple of people were like,
I'm terrified.
Political. Yeah. I mean, I don't recommend people read their own reviews, even though I too go look at mine occasionally. But
yeah, I'm terrified of Goodreads.
Yeah. Goodreads is not for authors. It's for readers. No, I always remind myself of that. But the like one of the things people did say is that it's so political. And I was like, I mean, you can definitely take it that way. And I think the note, the history note and the author's note at the end, also frame it that way when you're finished with the book. You get more of the political framing from it. But in it, like, it didn't feel that way reading it. I mean, like, you think about it and it spurs those thoughts, but it doesn't feel like a diatribe of any kind. So I was kind of surprised by the review that was like that. And I was like, maybe they didn't agree with the politics in the book as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. You know, I think as someone who approaches witch trials and the concept of the witch very much so from like a historian standpoint, witch trials are so political. I think they're like the prime example of something that is both political and personal.
Right.
And like the historical note talks about this a lot, but like so much of witch trials in Scotland and in other places were about like targeting people on the fringes of society, these marginalized people. So I think that the, I felt like I couldn't write a book that included witch trials, which like, even though it's set in an alternate version of Edinburgh, all of the things that I used to talk about witch trials really did come from the country's history with them in previous centuries. Yeah. So I just don't think for me that I could approach that or approach like a queer story in general, especially like a historical queer story without it feeling, you know, quote unquote political to some degree, because these are people that were sort of pushed to the edges.
Yeah.
So.
No, that totally makes sense. And I think, you know, looking at Scotland's history of witch trials, I mean, maybe other than Germany, they're really the most brutal.
Yeah.
Ones. Extremely they were brutal. Just extremely brutal. And James has a lot to answer for. That's all I got to say about that. But but yeah, I was just like, okay, this, and it made so much sense to me. Like, one, for folks who have not had the opportunity to read the book yet, the alternate Edinburgh, there are still witch trials happening into the 1800s, which largely those had ended by the mid 1700s.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you have the Witchcraft Act of 1735 that made it so that, you know, you couldn't just like charge someone for witchcraft in the same way that they had been doing previously. So that was also something that I wanted to like, I went back and forth with how to handle that in the book. And so like, even in this alternate version of 1824, there's still like, you know, people aren't necessarily being tried and hung as witches. They're being tried for like other crimes, but it's very socially known that the actual accusation is witchcraft.
Yeah,
Which I thought was kind of a fun well, fun, but sort of like an interesting way to approach it, because I did want to look at, like, put a witch trial in a time period that we think of as relatively modern, and especially like looking at it from mm-hmm. a like academic historical standpoint, the 19th century is very modern.
Yeah.
But, you know, I still believe that some of those mindsets that caused witch trials and witch panic still exist in other ways post when witch trials actually occurred.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think even to the present day, there's still like if you look at, you know, the satanic panic in the 90s and mm-hmm. even like a lot of the stuff around in the U.S., like around the QAnon conspiracy stuff, it's kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
And also goes back even further to like blood libel garbage about Jewish people. I mean, like mm-hmm. it's all connected. So.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So that part was really fascinating to me. And I had to remember like public, because this is 1824, there are public hangings. And I was like, yeah, public executions didn't end in some places until the 1900s.
Yeah, yeah. And they were, you know, I have them set on Grassmarket, one of the sort of main roads in Edinburgh, which did have hangings in previous centuries, but they had sort of moved to a slightly different location by 1824. Mm-hmm. But I did kind of, it's like a throwaway brief mention, like one of the early chapters, that like the people that were being tried for quote unquote normal crimes were still in this normal location, but the people that were like, you know, whisper under the breath being mm-hmm. tried for witchcraft were on Grassmarket. And there's like still a memorial there for people that were hung for various crimes. But I think mm-hmm. that when people visit Edinburgh and they think about these public executions, that like Lawn Market, Grassmarket area is what mm-hmm. comes to mind.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think the history of it was fascinating. And, you know, reading your bio and knowing that you had this background in history, like that part of it was just fascinating to me. And I always love alternate history stories anyway. Like, yeah. I'm always a sucker for that. One of the things that I thought was really interesting, you touched on like writing a queer historical story. And mm-hmm. I think it's so, as a writer, sometimes it's hard to remember that when you're talking about queer people in the past, they would not have used that word. They would have used most of our nomenclature we have today. Mm-hmm. And then as the characters come into the modern era in the book, it's like they've discovered what they were. Like they have learned over time these words and phrases and ways to talk about things. As a reader and as a writer, I was like, oh, it was so beautifully done.
Thank you. Yeah, that was something that I really wanted to do. And like as a queer person, I wanted to have like the main character say on page like she's bisexual and have that, mm-hmm. you know, the readers don't have to sort of wonder. I mean, there's a central like sapphic queer romance. You're going to know that she's mm-hmm. queer, but her mm-hmm. like, you know, way that she identifies, I really wanted it to be like on page clear. And then I was like, well, I can't do that in the past. And like, there's also a trans woman in the past timeline that's a very mm-hmm. prevalent character. And, you know, I was working with a trans sensitivity reader to be like, how do I, like, I wanted to say it because I think it's important to have, you know, people's identities mm-hmm. just like set on page for readers to see. So yeah, I worked with her a bit on that of like, okay, well, in the modern timeline, we do have those words. So then we can, you know, mm-hmm. people can then apply them to themselves and have that language in modern day.
Yeah. And I mean, Ari, the character that you're talking about, like her, she is very important to the story. We don't see mm-hmm. a whole lot of her. Yeah. Like, I mean, because there's a lot of stuff that happens, but one of the things about it that I thought was really lovely is like her family is very accepting of her. And I was like, how lovely to have a story where that's not the hardship. The hardship is really this misogyny that affects all of them in the witch trials.
Yeah.
And
I think, I mean, like obviously with a trans character, I was like, that hardship is just like not my story to tell. I wouldn't know how to tell it. But I just, in general, with all of the queer characters, I just didn't want their like queerness or like not being accepted by loved ones to be central to the story. Like all of the queer characters, when their loved ones like understand their identity, they just accept it. And it is, you know, never something that they are like facing as like a trial or a hardship, except for how society might view it. And that's mm-hmm. because it ties in with misogyny, which is really mm-hmm. like the main sort of challenge that the characters are up against, in a sense.
Yeah. So I don't know how much you want to give away about the central theme of the book.
Yeah.
But I love the weaving of the mythology mm-hmm. into that, and that's really the thread that pulls them from the past to the future.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of say a bit vague, but like the women in the story, or the people in the story, really, that are, you know, quote unquote witches, are sort of like followers of a Scottish deity, the Cailleach, and they, like, it's really about them living in her image, in a sense, I guess. Mm-hmm. And just because she is viewed as this sort of like, she's a tough lady. And there's a whole variation of different stories about her. She was originally like a creator figure in, you know, more Irish stories. She becomes more of like a term or a figurehead. But I mean, I talk about in one of the notes that, like, I really focused it on one version of the story. But that was originally like the very, very first base idea. Didn't have that like folklore element woven mm-hmm. through, and the story just like didn't work. I found I didn't really care about it in the mm-hmm. same way. And then I was just thinking about it, and I was like, okay, well, I've been obsessed with this figure and these stories for years now. And I've always been like, I'm going to, you know, put her in a story somewhere. I just have to figure it out. And I talked to my editor, and I was like, I think I like wrote a story for her without realizing, like, the folklore just like fit in seamlessly with mm-hmm. everything that was already created. And then I just sort of made that the heart of the story, and it completely came together yeah. from there. And I think really grounded it in Scotland mm-hmm. specifically, rather than just felt like it was, you know, something that could have happened anywhere. Because this folklore, of course, is very like focused on nature, with having the main deity be like a creator of the landscape, or being, you know, like a winter thunder god. And that is something that I really love about Edinburgh, that it is this major city, but it is also so close to nature, and like stunning nature, like things that don't look real. So I thought it was just kind of a perfect way to mm-hmm. play around with all those concepts together.
Yeah. Yeah. I really enjoyed that part of it. And I think it's interesting to learn that came after the original story, because mm-hmm. it seems like the genesis for it. So I think you're right. You wrote the story, you just didn't put it in yet.
Yeah, because so. It was just always in my head, mm-hmm. I guess. Like I was always thinking about the Cailleach, and like, what am I going to do with this figure that is just so important to me in my personal life, and that I know so much about.
Yeah. So this is your second book.
Yes.
So I wanted to ask you two questions that kind of relate to that. The first one is, so what was your original publishing journey like for your first book?
Yeah. So for my first book, it was the like second completed book that I wrote. And the first one was one of those ones that, you know, like was just trying out mm-hmm. writing a full book, not really a complete story in any way. And I worked on what would be my debut for my master's in creative writing. It was like my final project. Mm-hmm. And then about 3 months after turning it in, I found my agent, who just like found me talking. I think it was like a pitch contest, or she found it through me talking about it on social media, and reached out to me. I sent her the full, and it was one of those sort of like dream scenarios that after a year of querying almost to the day, she within like 48 hours offered representation. And was wonderful, because like the perfect home for that book. Mm-hmm. And then the submission was also fairly painless comparatively. You know, we get there. And then I sold the books in a two book deal. So The Last Witch in Edinburgh wasn't really like the star of the show for what we were selling. Like I sold that one on pretty much like one paragraph pitch that was more just like me saying to my agent, I have all of these things that I've been obsessed with for years, like obsessed with researching, and I'm somehow going to make them into a story together. Mm-hmm. We'll see how. So that was kind of interesting, especially because my first book is very, very different than this second book. And mm-hmm. the second book feels a lot more me in many ways.
Interesting. Do you think that was writing in that academic setting?
I think partially, I think also with the first book, I was very aware of the idea of like writing for the market, and wanting to, you know, like include things that I thought that readers would want to see, which is, you know, there's something to be said for that if you were trying to traditionally publish books. Whereas with the second book, I just kind of wrote it for myself because, like I said, it was like things like the witch trials and the history of Scotland and like these little like niche references throughout the book to like historical figures or stories that happen in certain places or the folklore, which is things that like a decade I had just been sitting on and like loving and obsessing over. So I just was like, this is a story of like all of the things that I'm fascinated with crammed together, and didn't really think so much about it being a book that other people would read until afterwards. And I do think that that is a big part of it.
Yeah. Yeah. More written for you, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of books are thinly veiled obsessions of the author.
Yeah. That's why, like, I said to my editor at the time, I was like, I know that this sounds ridiculous, but like, can I please have an author's note and a historical note? Because I just need, like, if there's anybody else that wants to nerd out with these topics, I want them to have what is basically like a research paper with footnotes in the back of the book, which was originally like 2 or 3 times its length. And I just had to keep scaling it down.
Yeah.
Clearly an obsession book.
So now that this book is out in the world, like, is it, has it kind of changed how you feel about the first book, or were you just kind of like relieved?
I do think it's changed how I feel about the first book, and that I feel a bit more distance from the first one, in a sense. Like, the first one was very focused on mental health and really spoke to where I was at the time of writing it. But now it's been like 5 years since I wrote it. So I think even just that, like being 5 years removed from the, you know, like early stages of writing something, you're different, your life is different. So just, yeah, I still will always love it because it's my first book, but I do think there's a bit of remove. I feel like I'm being much more like open in the second one.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things that you talked about in the notes was like just the challenge of the sophomore novel.
Yeah.
What specifically for you was like the sticking point for this one?
I think one of the sticking points in the beginning was because I was writing about so many things that I had like lovingly researched for a while just for my own entertainment. I had trouble figuring out where to pull back or like chill out in the book a little bit and like remember that it is a fiction that like I'm, you know, I would say my books are like historically inspired. They're not necessarily historically accurate. But as somebody who like studied history, that was kind of like difficult for myself at times to be like, okay, I'm setting this in an alternate timeline, an alternate version of the city. I had to allow myself to like loosen up. Otherwise it would in some parts just like read like a research paper. And then I think I also had trouble from like an emotional or like a mental standpoint with writing a queer book when my first book was not queer. And I think that that was quite difficult and part of like my own coming out in very much so happened with this book. Because I was like, okay, if I want this book to be out in the world, I want to be able to be myself as well along with it and talk about that and find other, you know, queer readers. And with that, like a sense of responsibility to a degree of wanting to really make a book that is a space that like queer readers can come to. And that even though there are a lot of, you know, like chaos and hardships and all sorts of things in this book, that it is still like a safe space for queer readers. And that it was very yeah, just that it felt like the right space. And so I really appreciated, you know, like I mentioned, I worked with like a trans woman that was my sensitivity reader, I guess. Yeah. And she just like really helped me make sure that I was, you know, doing that the way that I wanted to. And that mm-hmm. 'cause so much of the book is about these, just like facing misogyny in general. And I think like homophobia and all of that sort of goes hand in hand with that. So yeah, just sort of making mm-hmm. sure that I was making a good space for my own community.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense to me. I saw this thing recently, I think on Threads. I don't know. It all runs together. Right. And someone was saying that they were just tired of the bisexual trope, and somebody commented and they were like, you know, it's not a trope, right? Like, these are people.
It's
like,
life. Yeah.
And I thought, you know, like I have read so few books that have really good bisexual representation mm-hmm. that I was like, where's this trope? Can you point me to these books?
Yeah, exactly. I would love to hear about this trope.
Yeah. Can you tell me your reading list you're tired of? Can you share that with the rest of us? Yeah. I thought it was just such an amusing comment. I was like, oh, the trend. And I was like, it's not really a trend. I think people are just being themselves.
I think that was also a part of it. That like once I decided that I was going to make this a queer book and like really allow myself to explore that, not only like wanting it to be a good space for the queer community, but then I was also later in the game was like, oh, with that is going to come like biphobia and homophobia. Mm-hmm. And that was like mental thing that I had to prepare for in a way I didn't have to with my first book.
Yeah. I mean, have you gotten any pushback?
I don't know because I don't look at reviews.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. So yeah, nothing.
I can't say that I saw it in reviews I've been tagged in. So
that's great. Yeah. So. Nothing I've been tagged in or messages that I've been sent so far. Yeah. What happens in the reviews that are not tagging me? I have no idea.
But who cares? Yeah.
So far it's been, so far it's been okay.
I also don't understand tagging authors in reviews. Like, I'm like, it's not really for the author. It's for other readers. And especially if you're going to say something shitty, why would you tag them?
I'm sort of at the point where like I have a friend or my partner go through like my tags before I look at them myself, because if they are like negative for my own mental health, I don't really want to read it despite being tagged in it. Or just sometimes I, you know, like we said, feel uncomfortable even if I'm tagged, like wading into reader space, I guess. So I sort of like send someone out to do it on my behalf and then look at it when I'm ready. But it is so wonderful to hear have people like reach out with the way that, you know, the books speak to them or that they enjoyed it. That does make the struggles of the sophomore book a bit nicer at the end of the day.
Yeah. And for listeners, Marielle and I were talking before, and I told her my comfort read, and I've said this on the show before, is Amy McKay's Witches of New York. I think this will be added to the comfort read list because it hits it hits that same spot that Witches of New York hit. Even though I think technically the Witches of New York is later in the 1800s. It's closer to the turn of the century.
1880s, I want to say, or like 1860s.
Yeah. So, but it hits that same like historical, like modern, but not where we are now. Not like jet and computer age modern.
Right.
Like,
exactly.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, and even then with the modern parts of this book, when like social media is utilized by the character, I just have it be like social media where the main character is like a 200-year-old woman. And she's like, I don't know about that, but these young people do.
Yeah.
To sort of keep it from being too tech heavy, which is a whole other route, I think, to look at like modern witchcraft.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, there's always that rope, I feel like a tightrope you have to walk as an author about being specific for the time period you're talking about and not dating your book. And I've kind of fallen on the side of I'd rather be true to the time period that I'm talking about. But it's hard to go, you know, like I think about all the books I read from, you know, the early 90s where there's no cell phones.
Yeah.
And then you read those books now and you're like, that's so weird that there's no cell phones. And you're like, oh, it was so much easier because a cell phone can solve a lot of plot problems.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, that's like, it even bothers me that like the second half of the book is set in modern day, and by modern day it's 2022. Mm-hmm. And it does like bother me a little bit that like the first half of the book is in 1824. It would be much more satisfying to have set it in 2024. That's when the book is coming out. It would have, you know, that like clean 200 years would have been great. But because so much of the book looks at the way that misogyny affects people in the past and as well in the present, I contemplated doing mm-hmm. the second half in 2024. But I was like, unfortunately, we have no idea what misogyny will look like in the UK in 2024. So I just sort of set it in 2022 of like when I was writing. I mean, there's mm-hmm. mentions of like the characters are briefly in the US, and there's a quick mention of like Roe v. Wade being overturned. And, you know, I think that it was, I wanted it to feel in our social time. So I had to go a few years further back.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's so many touches of that to kind of pull it together. And I mean, I think, you know, when folks read it, there's that aspect of it. There's like the misogyny and you know, like trans misogyny. And then there's a part later where it really pulls into like all the intersectionality stuff about feminism and all of that. And then, but when you're reading, you know, like in this first read of the book, I was like, oh God, this is climate change. Like, this is it right here. Yeah. And that to me was like the initial, like, oh yeah. And then all of that other stuff is in there, but like so much of the broader arc of the story, I was like, oh, this is climate change.
Yeah. And like the folklore that it's based off of, I don't want to give too many spoilers, I guess, mm-hmm. but it's, you know, based off of one specific story that was actually written by a Scottish folklorist in 1917. Mm-hmm. I might be off near, but it was the 20th
it's in
century
the note
that
for folks who read it. Yeah, exactly. It's in the note.
it's in the footnotes. But yeah, he wrote it in the 20th century, and it's very sort of like his own play on earlier versions of the folklore. But he really focused in this idea of like that springtime battle between winter and summer, and like put mm-hmm. that, you know, temperate mm-hmm. battle onto these folklore figures. And that was a big part of why I chose that specific version to reimagine and play with a little bit, because I was like, oh, this idea of battling between summer mm-hmm. and winter is so applicable to climate change. And I think that, like, you know, when I lived in Edinburgh, we had the side of Arthur's Seat caught on fire one mm-hmm. year, and I believe it was like October, just because it was so dry and we had so much heat that the brush just like caught on fire, and it was quite a big deal. And it happens occasionally, but you know, that's also something that I remember a professor was saying to us didn't used to happen as much, because it is now just mm-hmm. getting warmer. And this idea that the landscape is used to a different climate, and now things are shifting because of climate change, was a really like interesting sticking point that I came to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that part actually made me think of the fires here in California, especially this year, because mm-hmm. we did actually have winter and rain and all of those things. Uh-huh. But it also made the grass grow like mad, and now it's all dried out and 6 feet tall and ready to catch on fire. So I was like, oh, that totally makes sense. But yeah, no, that aspect of it really hit me reading it. And I think especially just in, like, you know, reading it during a heat wave, I was like, oh, I feel ominous. This so level. So I mean, obviously the title of the podcast is Witchlit. So yeah. I was curious, why witches for you? Like, why witches?
Yeah, I was one of those small children that was like obsessed with the figure of the witch. Like I'm on home videos, like doing play pretend of like being one of the wicked witches, and, you know, sort of the idea of being fascinated by the figure of the witch, even though it, especially still when I was young, was quite a negative mm-hmm. figure. It was often like this idea of an older woman, and she's ugly and she's mean and all of that. And I also, as a child, lived quite close to Salem, Massachusetts. So a lot of my like early childhood education really integrated that and visiting those sites. So the mm-hmm. idea of witch trials was something that I had, you know, in my mind, and knew a lot about from when I was young and was really interested in. And yeah, I think I sort of became obsessed with learning about Scotland's witch trials. I want to say like 2016, 2015, I really started to like go down the rabbit holes and just like read everything and research everything. And so I knew that if I was writing a story that was set in Edinburgh, that I wanted to include this concept of witches. And, you know, like the main characters sort of call themselves witches, but they acknowledge like other people that are like them don't call themselves witches, because I think it was important in that setting and in that historical landscape to recognize how dangerous of a term witch was, and that it was something that was put on to people. But then I liked in the modern timeline getting to look a bit more how there are people that are claiming that title positively and that they find it really empowering. And I think that that's something that, like, I see a lot of young women online especially find it to be a really empowering title because of its horrible history.
Yeah.
And so that was sort of a duality, a dichotomy that I wanted to get to look at in the past timeline versus the present.
Yeah, I always think of it like a lot about, you know, different waves of feminism reclaiming different words, like reclaiming bitch, reclaiming witch. You know, this is kind of a part of that. I've been thinking about, you know, and the phrase, the similar phrase happens in the book a couple of times. She was a woman, not a witch. And then I saw in the notes that you referenced the Witches of Scotland podcast, which I have loved and listened to every episode of. So I was like, oh, yes, this totally makes sense that there would be this intersection. So,
yeah. And I think like also there's right by Edinburgh Castle, there's like tucked away in the corner on one of the side buildings, there is like a little fountain memorial for those that were tried as witches in the country and in the city. And I want to say it was mentioned like the 1880s or 90s. But it's also like not, and I say this in the book because it was just like my own frustration coming through, that it wasn't an apology or an admission of wrongdoing, that this memorial has like one very like peaceful, beautiful face and one sort of like enraging face that looks a bit like the, that, you know, hag, witch negative stereotype. And that it is sort of, I don't know the phrasing off the top of my head, but sort of is this idea of like, oh, well, some of the people that were tried as witches were innocent. And like some, you know, but it sort of leaves empty of like, but some maybe not, you know, and that just enraged me so much that I was like, okay, well, I need to bring all of this into a book because I need to put the anger somewhere. That was pretty much what the whole book was, is that I have all of these things that I was just like angry and frustrated and fed up with. And I needed to put that out there.
And for folks who haven't listened to the Witches of Scotland podcast, that's kind of their, the reason they started the podcast was to get a formal apology, which has happened.
Yes.
And to get a memorial to all of the people in Scotland who were tried as witches and, and executed and just had their lives ruined, even if they weren't executed. But one of the things I think is interesting when in that idea with the first memorial that, you know, some of them maybe were witches. And I was like, okay, so even if they were witches by what our standards would be today, they were never witches by their standards.
No, no. I mean, the if you read what they were defining witches as in, you know, the like 200-year span, it's absurdity. It's like very clearly just like excuses to try people, to have control. Julian Goodair is a, I believe he's an Edinburgh-based historian, but he has this wonderful quote that I'm going to paraphrase a bit, but basically that like misogyny didn't need witch trials, that this idea of like the patriarchy would have continued and found another way to harm women without witch trials, but that witch trials would not have been possible without patriarchy. And I think that that just sort of sums it all up.
Yeah, and but, I think that that feeling in the first half of the book during the these alternate 1824 witch trials, that sense of like the just like inevitability of it.
Yeah.
And like the women turning on each other part is just like gut-wrenching, but you're like, no, that's what happened. And that's what happens today too.
Yeah, so. I think a lot of people have this misconception when they think about patriarchy and witch trials, that it was just like men accusing women and that it sort of only went in that one direction. Whereas really, if you look at it historically, witch trials everywhere, but like especially in Scotland, were able to be so damaging and so long lasting because it convinced women to turn against each other. And then there was no sense of community. Like it sort of created this idea of like, to save myself, I have to damn someone else.
Yeah.
And that is what strengthened it. And that like is patriarchy in a nutshell in a lot of things we see today too.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, not like one of the other like famous UK trials, not in Scotland, the Pendleton witches, like I mean, the daughter was the accuser or the witness that really condemned a lot of these people. And I think about that a lot, about like just using a child against the family and and how horrific that is. And it happened in lots of other places too. It happened in Sweden. It happened in Germany, you know, like those kind of things. But I am glad that we have moved on in the witchcraft, like actual modern witchcraft community or contemporary witchcraft community, from this idea that there were millions and millions of women and they were witches or midwives and all that stuff. I'm like, that's not the true history. The true history is in many ways more horrific.
Yeah.
Even though it's not the millions of people that, you know, we were told in like, I don't know, what is the Canadian documentary from like the 90s? I can't even think of it. But, you know, like it has a Lorena McKennitt soundtrack is the thing I remember about it. But I can't remember the name. But it was basically that still hanging on to this idea and hanging on to a lot of Margaret Murray ideas about the history of witchcraft. And I was like, I'm glad we finally moved past that.
Yeah.
Because I think it's important to realize that these were completely innocent people. I mean, they might have been, you know, curmudgeons. They might have been, you know, like crabby people, or they might have been disliked by the community, but they weren't what they were accused of being.
Right. So, exactly.
Yeah. But it is, I don't know, that part, like, I feel like, you know, there's a lot. I think there's a lot we're still learning.
Yeah.
And a lot that the thing that I find interesting, and I don't know, like if in your research you've come across this, but that contemporary witches are looking at those, I guess, you know, forced confessions and tortured confessions and things like that, and kind of mining it for the folklore that did exist at the time, that they're like, you know, when they make them talk about the devil because of all the leading questions and stuff, you know, they're talking about like the folk fairy beliefs of a lot of places. And that kind of stuff, I think, is interesting. And I'm just so glad we've gotten past this mythology of it and are really looking at the history of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that was also something that I found very interesting looking at Scotland specifically, that a lot of the like social unrest that came through in a lot of different ways was sort of based in this idea of like tampering down folklore beliefs and like replacing beliefs with Christianity. I mean, you see that specifically with like the folklore that I use in the book, that like folklorists tracked directly this idea of like the belief that witches would like start storms or change shape could be tracked down in connection to like, you know, these specific bits of folklore from this specific region. But yeah, I definitely think that that is a big part of it that I'm glad that people are looking at for what it was.
Yeah. So I'm going to ask this and you can pass and say no, and we can cut this part out. But I'm just curious, like what your own position is like on contemporary witchcraft now.
Yeah. So a lot of the stuff that the, you know, witches in quotes do in my book are things that I do myself. And like, I have friends that will call me a witch, but it's not like a term that I use because I so think of it in that historical context. So it doesn't feel right for me. But so much of the book is like this idea of nature-based witchcraft, which is just sort of with it focusing on a deity that's a creator deity of the Scottish landscape. Really like taking care of the land and like ways to utilize the land. And that's something that I think is very important. And I especially, you know, like I said, in Scotland, I would go for these like hour-long walks just through nature and like to the ocean and, you know, just ways to feel it in touch with the landscape and to sort of appreciate the landscape that I was living amongst and its beauty and its history. And also, I'm very much so like the characters in the book that I really love, like figures from folklore and mythology. And, you know, the main story that's explored in the book is one that like I loved in my personal life. And I really, mm-hmm. way before writing this, looked up to, you know, this idea of like a female figure that is feared because she's not beautiful. And she's like literally and figuratively quite cold. And she has this like community of quote unquote hag witches around her and like her hag servants. And so, yeah, I guess like my own form of witchcraft is sort of similar in the book to like wanting mm-hmm. to embrace these traits of the folklore, like wanting to, yeah, learn to like appreciate land and to help care for it a bit mm-hmm. in the ways that I can.
Yeah. No, and again, I think that goes back to, you know, kind of the climate crisis stuff in a way too. But mm-hmm. I read a lot of the book in bed and I really wanted a cup of tea. Like for 75% of the book, I was like, I really need some tea.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I so appreciate the, I guess the idea that there are always gathering spaces for women
yeah.
who are interested in these things, because there's one in the past in the book and there's mm-hmm. one in the contemporary part of the book.
Yeah.
And I thought that thread of that idea of, you know, somehow there are always women who find a place to gather yeah. to help each other. Like that seems mm-hmm. consistent throughout cultures.
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess at the, you know, like when your readers are done with this book, and I hope that, you know, we will find more readers today, but what do you want them to walk away from the book with?
I mean, like you're just saying, because so much of the book is about communities of people like with shared experiences and how they can find solace and empower in these communities, I hope that readers can walk away from the book feeling that sense that they were a part of these communities in the book. Mm-hmm. And also just to a degree, a sense of feeling seen in their frustrations and their hardships. Like a lot of the more modern aspect of the book came from, I just realized that I was perpetually sad of seeing in the news so often women that were like harmed walking home mm-hmm. and that it just was very, it was affecting me really, really deeply every time that I saw these news stories, and they were so frequent, and I just was so sort of fed up and frustrated that this is how so many people, not just women, but so many people are forced to live never really feeling safe. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the book was just wanting to get that frustration out and maybe have a place that other people feeling those things can see that frustration on the page. And, you know, it's not necessarily solving any of these issues, but I think just feeling seen in it. And yeah, again, mm-hmm. like that metaphorical even sense of a community with fictional characters, I hope mm-hmm. gives yeah. people a little solace.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed that. So moving in the way that publishing works, I assume that you're working on something now.
Yes.
So moving forward, do you feel like this book has opened doors for other stories for you?
I think so. I think that because it's so different from my second book, I think that like the readers that this book hopefully finds are really like the readers that will stay with the other stories I'm writing. Like I'm currently editing like a sapphic gothic set in Switzerland that's very much so about another 19th century one, of course, mm-hmm. but it's very much so like about female rage and the idea of how, you know, when class comes into it, when pretty privilege comes into it, and like marriage status, different ways that women can cope with the frustrations of mm-hmm. the limitations put onto them. So I do think that, you know, all of the books that I'm working on since The Last Witch in Edinburgh are in conversation with it to a degree. Yeah. And I'm, you know, like I've started to return to stories of women that were tried as witches in like mm-hmm. different parts of the world that I've lived, and like stories that I've had of mm-hmm. these women and how they, you know, all sort of around the world, there's a similar thread a lot of the time, unfortunately, in how like older women were often connected to witchcraft. And so that's mm-hmm. seems like it's going to be a recurring theme in a lot of the books I write.
Yeah. Well, I wonder, like, if growing up near Salem didn't maybe put that seed in there.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I always joke, we try to keep it to an hour and I usually fail, but, but I wanted to give you an opportunity before we do our last question to kind of, you know, let people know where to find you, find your work, anything you have coming yeah. up. This will air in the witchy season the week before yes, Halloween.
Perfect. So. yeah, I mean, you can find me on Instagram at by Marielle Thompson. And I'm sure when this comes out, I will be like all over the place talking about Samhain and the kayak and the book and everything, because it's the perfect season. October is very important in the story. Mm-hmm. And yeah, The Last Witch in Edinburgh will be for sale everywhere that books are sold.
Yeah. And I can wholeheartedly endorse that. Go get it. Go read it.
Thank you.
It's a lovely read. Awesome. So our last question is a little bit of a game of chance.
Yeah.
I always joke that I'm a devil Scorpio, so I don't know how to do small talk. I always want people, you know, want to ask people their deep, dark secrets when I meet them.
It's okay. I'm a Pisces moon, so me too.
Yeah. It's just, I'm like, I'm, you know, yes, the weather is interesting, but, you know, what do you think about death? No. I'm going to roll a die, and depending on what I okay. roll, I'm going to question about death, sex, religion, politics, or money.
Amazing.
World six, you get to pick which question you want, and you can pass because, you know, rolls are meant to be bent.
Yeah.
Six, you get to pick. Haven't had Ooh. One of those in a while. What would you like?
I'll go with death.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I don't think this gives away too much in the book, but the characters can be long lived mm-hmm. and they have a second life. So. Yes. If you were to be able to have this gift, would you take it?
I think the concept of a long life, like in the book, the premise is that these, you know, followers of this deity get a longer life and that they age only physically a decade for every century about. That I don't think I would want to. I don't think I would want to risk being like 500 years old. I mean, I'm not even 30 now, so that would be a lot of centuries potentially ahead of me.
Yeah.
That, no. But the idea of being able to come back to life after death, at least in the way that it is in the book, where like mm-hmm. they don't have a memory of death, that it's sort of like an hour and they come back and they might have like a physical memory of however they died, that I think I would do. I'm a very clumsy person. That might end up helping me out in the long run.
Yeah. Yeah. And for folks who are going to read the book or have read the book, you'll know that this plays a very important part in the whole story.
Yes.
But I was really fascinated with it. I liked the way that you do it because I think there is always in, you know, the mythology around witches is that they mm-hmm. are immortal or don't age or they're not human somehow.
Yeah.
And I think that aspect of it, they just age really slowly. And they, you know, because yeah. of their service to this deity, mm-hmm. they have this opportunity for a second life. And I was like, okay, I really liked kind of the twist on that.
Yeah. I mean, that was the very first idea, like the seed of the story came from that premise that I was mm-hmm. taking a walk in New Calton Burial Ground in Edinburgh. And they have this big watchtower there that, you know, people during grave robbings were, which is also happening around the time books that were stationed there to look out for grave mm-hmm. robbers. And I had this idea of like, well, what if there was somebody there and they saw a body get dug up, but that's because the person is still alive, or rather they're like alive again. And then mm-hmm. I was like, oh, I have to do something with yeah. that. And the whole story sort of, it came out of that concept of coming back to life.
Yeah. No, I really liked that. And I know, like, I think that is one of the things that you see in the work of writers who have studied history closely or academically, is there's all those pieces woven together.
Yeah.
Because it is happening when there's grave robbing and there's that aspect of it. And then that is woven into the story in a unique yeah. way. And so I don't know. It's like, you know, I know a lot of people kind of joke that Deborah Harkness's books are really long. Yeah. But that is her, like the history of alchemy is
so much
her
historical detail.
Yeah. The history of alchemy is like literally she has a PhD in it. Yeah. And like you see it in the books. There's just so much of that there. And I was like, no, give me that. Like, I'm kind of glad our editor didn't make her cut it. I want to read that.
I will take 500 pages of historical detail. No question.
So, yeah, it's funny to me because and people always want different things. Like, some people don't want any description and some people don't want dialogue and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I want it all. Just bring it. Yeah. Give me a doorstop book. I love it. So, awesome. Well, Marielle, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for reaching out. And just a reminder to folks, like, you can reach out to me if you want to be on the show. Yeah. Good luck with continuing with, you know, your first two books and all the things that come next. I can't wait to read about this sapphic story in Switzerland. Gothic, bring it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Witch Lit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shinekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to and reading Witch Lit.